Somebody else.
Okay, so I just wanted to give you an idea of some of the topics that people will be discussing. And I want to start at the beginning and just sort of give you a flavor of it, okay? So I'll try to get topical at the end of each little topic, but I'm going to start off as if it's really all new stuff, okay? But because of that, I'll have to jump around a little bit. So so you'll have to fill in all these gaps with your own imagination. But I want to try to discuss a number of topics that people are working on. First of all, Gladys fermions, okay? And then people are working on high temperature environments and lattice gauge theory, and then people are working on, well, this is a real killer, high chemical potential. And then I want to say a couple of words about inspirational new topics from string theory, von Hinfeld theories. And this material doesn't exist, but it's indicative of directions that we might start off in lattice gauge theory, taking an attitude that one of the things about lattice gauge theory is to develop new methods and pursue new directions. A great deal of the workshop is based on developments now, which is the refining of methods that have been out there and the use of lattice gauge theory to get numbers out of QCD. I'm not going to spend much time on that here just because I've got to make choices. Okay, to cover some topics in 1 hour, I just will have to just make some choices. No, so I'll just hit those topics. But a lot of us are doing QCD style, quantitative material, and Junko and Esty are running a program on that, and there'll be lots of talks on that. I just don't think I'm going to have much time for the large-scale computational aspect of the field and the QCD calculations. Well, if you're doing those calculations, you have to worry about how to put fermions on a lattice, and that tends to be kind of tricky. Let's say we're doing we're replacing space-time by a spatial grid, maybe a continuum of time, or we're doing a spatial grid and a grid of time as well. I'll sort of flip between different descriptions just so I can illustrate some ideas. Okay, fermions on a lattice. Well, we all know, just from solid state physics, you know that putting bosons on a lattice, there are no surprises. But if you put fermions on a lattice, you run into all sorts of aggravations. Okay? So imagine doing just 1 plus 1 dimensional Dirac equation. Okay, and you write down the Dirac equation in a conventional fashion, where alpha is one of the Dirac operators in this particular case. In 1 plus 1 dimension, it's basically gamma 5, the thing that measures chirality. Okay, and you write that down, and you look for the plane wave solutions, and you find the usual things that you have energies for fermions and anti-fermions, and you have states of chirality that could be either plus or minus 1. Okay, and so you have a nice spectrum for those particular states, and we all know how to interpret them and everything is fine. Okay, in the continuum. Now you throw that on the lattice, and let's just say you'll do a lattice of spatial points, and you'll just stick on each one of these points of psi in two dimensions. It's just of psi 1 and of psi 2, and you just stick that on the lattice in the most naive discretization. Okay, so I just write that down. Okay, the simplest discrete discretization, where A is the lattice spacing and gamma 5 is that. So the discrete difference would just be this, and I'm imagining that time is a continuous variable, because I'll get into trouble illustrating this, and it's easier to illustrate continuum of time figures than that. So if you just write that down, there it is. And now I look for plane wave solutions of the same variety as before. And then I'll find my equation for the energy when I do that in the same way that I would over here. And we all know, really, just in solid state applications, what this looks like. From the plane wave solutions and the fact that these are point split, right? If I'm looking at the time derivative here, I have to note this spatial character here because of the derivative coupling, the first order derivative coupling. And so I'll get an energy expression that looks like this. Okay? And then the exact form is this. Okay. Nothing new, but it's a problem for lattice physics because you see here in the continuum you only have low energy for low k, but on the lattice you have low energy for low k and also at the edges of the bluing zone. Now that shows up in particular if you look at states of definite chirality. Okay, this chi plus, for example, just one of those, just chi plus, and then you plot. You know, the energy is a function of momentum, but the momentum is now running over the bluing zone. Right? And it looks just like this. Okay, and so if you want to look at low energy states, something down here, okay, so you'll then find a fermion, a right moving fermion here, and then you'll find a left moving one as well over here, okay? And you see a pair of fermions, and just from the, and just because the chirality in 1 plus 1 dimensions is just velocity, this fellow is positive chirality, this fellow here, I should loop it around on a band, is negative chirality. I see what's the problem in the game, which is called species doubling, okay? I don't have any particular clean way of just looking at the origin. I have to go out to the bluing zone. I get twice as many degrees of freedom as I had before. And I also see that with every positive chirality fellow, I have a negative chirality fellow. And so I have that the chiralities of the species on the lattice add to zero. Okay. And that's my problem. Because that's not QCD. And I have these extra species to deal with if I just throw down the Dirac equation in the most naive fashion. You might say, well, I'll try and get the fractions, and that's the game. Okay, well, I mean, why did I choose this particular discrete difference? There are other ways of doing it, of cleaning it up. And one way to clean it up is due to Wilson. Oh, let me mention that unless I can't avoid it, I'm not going to make any references this hour, okay? Because I just can't go there, okay? I to be diplomatic, I just have to spend all of my time telling anybody Okay, so we'll just, it's called Wilson fermion. And what Wilson fermion does is that it adds to this equation, a term which raises the energy of the states near the edge of the bluing zone with its irrelevant operator. An operator disappears when A goes to zero, but raises it when A is non-zero and gets rid of the extra species. That sounds good, but the trouble is when you look at the details of that, you find that the price you paid is that you completely destroy chiral symmetry. Okay, in other words. I'm trying to say that this is just in a language outside of field theory. That what that means is that if you start in an interacting theory with massless fermions, okay, and accept the Wilson term, that then there's nothing protecting you from masses developing dynamically, which are on the order of 1 over the lattice spacing. Okay, so you lose control over the masses of the basic fermions. Lose control over chiral symmetry in particular, that symmetry that keeps masses at zero and responsible for the, you know, for the pion, the low mass excitations in the physical spectrum. And so that's a real bad problem. All of chiral symmetry is lost. A terrible price to pay. Okay, you can deal with it by fine-tuning parameters, okay? But it's not a symmetry in a natural fashion. What people would like to do in these lattice games is to be able to discuss the field theory on a finite lattice at any coupling and have as many symmetries as they possibly can have, okay? There was an old philosophy which stated that, well, we don't really need all of those symmetries on the finite lattice, but let's just engineer the theory so that in a continuum limit that they all come back. okay? And Wilson can be engineered to do that, but we're really aiming at having all the synergies on the finite lattice in the present generation of work that's of interest to this workshop. As Wilson's fermions, and there's also staggered fermions, okay, another approach which was just stolen from solid state physics, okay, was a way of putting fermions on the lattice, which is just a modification of this. The idea of staggered fermions in that particular case is that, well, what happens, what went wrong here? You have twice as many degrees of freedom as you wanted, so why don't you try to get rid of that factor two by thinning the degrees of freedom? Okay, so the idea there is to take the lattice, and instead of putting two component fellows on each site, spread them out. Okay, put the one and the two in here, and so you need two sites to get the full Dirac equation. Okay, that's called staggered fermions, and without the details, let me just show you one aspect about it, which is sort of interesting. In the usual, in the base of the Dirac equation that I wrote down there, gamma phi is an off-diagonal operator, and that's a piece of chiral symmetry. That's an important. So if you have discrete chiral symmetry in the game, your theory can't develop a mass time. You can't get a mass counter term which doesn't violate that symmetry. So you might go side one, side two like this, and then do the Dirac equation from that perspective. You can figure all of that out. And what's interesting in this theory is that then one of the symmetries of the game would be that you could always just relabel your lattice so that you go from this side to this side by one side a shift. You see what happens in that game is that psi 1 then goes to psi 2, and psi 2 goes to psi 1, and you see that a shift by 1 of along the lattice is actually a discrete chiral symmetry, by a single gamma 5. That's gamma 5, psi 1, psi 2, and it just turns it over. So one of the aspects, and so people develop staggered fermions here. People do use staggered fermions in four dimensions for simulations. One of the nice things about it, and it's hinted at here, staggered fermions have a remnant of chiral symmetry. Not all of the chiral symmetries you want, but a remnant, and in many applications that's good. In four dimensions, it has a continuous remnant of the chiral symmetry, which gives you a massless Goldstone boson for free if the symmetry is spontaneously broken, and that's important for QCD applications. One of the big efforts in the QCD calculations that I'm not discussing is to do spectroscopy, and then this method is one of the going methods that people use and engineer better than I'm discussing here to do QCD precision calculations. You have a remnant of chiral symmetry, and it's curious. It's a mix. You get a kind of mixing between space-time symmetries, chiral symmetries, and flavor symmetries in that particular case. If I did a multiplet of fermions, all of that can be illustrated in ways like this. So the particular shifts along the lattice have an interpretation in terms of flavor and chiral. So it's a curious method. It has more symmetry than the Wilson method. It forbids bare mass counter terms, and that's quite nice. So you get into trouble with chiral symmetry typically, and you have to understand it. Now you might, this particular picture was very simple. And it's the basis, in fact, of an observation made long ago that it's hard to get out of these problems of species doubling. Okay, this particular example in the Wilson case, well, you see, I had a precise energy momentum relationship, and you might change the details a little bit, but you're not going to change the topology, is the point. These points are identified at the end of the Brillouin zone, and so you have a tube, and then you have a continuous distribution of E versus K. change some of the derivatives a little bit, add interactions. What tends to happen is that the details will change, but you'll still have a continuous curve which has species doubling in it. And that point was made precise by Nathan Vinomia, and they expressed under what conditions you can't beat species doubling. So for many years, it was thought that, well, we just can't really do everything we want to do. We're semi-screwed. Okay, we can live with it, okay, but we can't do things as elegant as we'd like. Okay, so the way is in the efforts of avoiding of tax evaders, we try to find ways around Nielsen Nehemiah that are also semi-practical. One of the first items that the tax evaders came up with is, well, Lisa Nielsen Nehemiah applied to four dimensions, and let's go up to five dimensions. So that's a method called the main wall fermions. And again, it's a method which actually was reinvented in high energy physics, but it's been known in solid state physics for a long time. The main wall fermions and the zero modes of the main wall fermions. So now you pay a price, you go up to one more dimension, okay? And you make the dynamics in the fifth dimension very simple and engineered in such a way that the physics of four dimensions is exactly what you want. Okay, allows the cutoff theory with all of the symmetries that you want. Okay, so the idea is in five dimensions write down the Dirac equation and put a domain wall in there, which means really to put in a mass dependent, let's just be the fifth dimension, S, and let the mass of the fermion as it exists in five dimensions, okay, have a kink-like structure in five dimensions, so that this would be the mass of the fermion as a function of S. So the language is a little different than the solid state language, but you don't think about the dependence being in the mass, but you put a wall in. But here we just put the wall in by letting M of S have that particular dependence. Then you write down the Dirac operator, okay, four plus one dimensions, okay, and so you'll just write it down like this. Okay, so it's in four plus one dimensions, and then the D slash will be in four dimensions, just the four-dimensional object. Make the fifth-dimensional one in here, engineer it so that if the gamma matrix that's relevant for it is chiral symmetry, okay, and then let's make it look like this. Okay, that's the five-dimensional problem. It's not really what you want, but now let's look for solutions of this, of that free Dirac equation, and we're particularly interested in the zero modes of it, but we need D slash on psi to be the zero solution of the five-dimensional Dirac equation. We're interested in zero modes, and we'll look for modes of a particular variety which will have the features that we want. In particular, solve it by making an Ansatz of just what do you call it? Just factored variables, okay? And look for a solution, okay? With the variables factored like this, okay? Just look for solutions. Look for solutions like this. In this particular basis, I'll choose the four-dimensional spin. This is four dimensions. This is, has all the S dependence. This is just four-dimensional space-time. Okay, look for solutions which are chiral. Okay, and then this part should solve just the piece of the problem that has S dependence. The separation of variables, in other words, I couldn't think of the word. So I'm learning E and M for the first time, and I have a problem in five dimensions, and I just look for solutions which have factored variables. So I look for solving the Dirac equation in the fifth dimension, okay, should solve this. I just solve this piece. separate from the separate from the other pieces. That's one of the few equations that I can solve out of just by inspection. Okay, just an exponential, and so it looks like looks like this. Okay, and so there you go. There's the domain wall solution. Okay, and then your engineer, so psi plus is annihilated by d5, and then I have my domain walls like this. Okay, the point being now that the only acceptable solutions are those that are finite, that will fall off. Okay, and so that picks out, you see, because of the plus or minus here, just one of the two psi plus minus solutions. Just in this particular case, you'll just have a positive chirality fermion bound to the defect, and the other one is inadmissible. Okay, so you're left just with a single chiral plus fermion, which is then engineered to solve the four-dimensional Dirac equation as well. Okay. Right. So you get rid of only one of the solutions is normalizable, and it's the only one that's physical, and the other one disappearing from the game. Okay. So you can make a theory, okay, which then satisfies this equation. It's not like the massless Dirac equation. That's what you want. Okay, so you can have four-dimensional fermion zero modes of the defect, and give you the basis to make solutions for the four-dimensional Dirac equation. And in this particular case, because this has a depth, only the acceptable one picks out a state of definite chirality. You have a single chiral fermion in four dimensions, at least for this free theory. Well, now you have to transcribe this to the lattice, and there are plenty of technicalities to think about. I don't mean to, I'm rushing because of the time, not because there's nothing to think about. There's a lot of technicalities to think about. In particular, the way this is done on the lattice, you'll set up a lattice in five dimensions. Okay, you'll do so with typical periodic boundary conditions. And so if I have a fifth dimension with a periodic boundary conditions, then you see I have, as I go out in S and come back to S, I have a kink and an anti-kink. Okay, so I'll have a chiral fermion on one defect and an opposite chirality fermion on the other defect, and those are just the right degrees of freedom then to make a mass to be the basis of a massless fermion, massless Dirac fermion, okay, in a vector theory. Okay, in other words, in this particular case, I just showed a kink. That's not natural in lattice gauge theory, where the fifth dimensional would be periodic boundary conditions. I'll also have the anti-fellow, and I can separate them far apart from one another, and then I have those two chiral fermions, and they compose a single massless Dirac fermion that then propagates in four dimensions, and they can do so by solving the four-dimensional Dirac equation masslessly. So that's what people are working on. Okay, in the lattice situation, okay, I can't make S an infinitely large variable. Okay. It has a certain length, and so there's a kink typically at S equals zero, and a kink at S equals LS over two. Okay, so LS would just be the number of links in the fifth dimension. Okay, so this method of fermions actually was thought about in the early days of fermions, and it was thrown out because in those days, we only had VAXs, okay, little computers, and doing four dimensions on a VAX was hard enough. The idea of doing five dimensions just seemed Okay, so now with larger computers, you think about doing simulations in five dimensions, and just, what the heck? Okay, just make a bigger cluster, and that's exactly what's done, right? And so you do that, you have to be careful because of one of the points here. You had a kink at s equals zero, and a kink, and the anti-kink halfway out. Okay, well if those two states overlap, then that's mixing between the different chiralities. That's chiral symmetry breaking. That leads to an uncontrollable mass term in the solution of the equation. So that's terrible. Okay? And so one of the engineering problems you want to do is to jigger all these differences in such a way that the overlap between this guy and this guy is really negligible. And that's been a problem for this method. That's definitely been a problem. There are ideas that are being discussed at this workshop on how to clean that up, and there are some interesting exercises there. Of course, it is obscene, because even those exercises, people are exploring new domain wall fermion methods, and to even do those exercises, they have to use the most powerful clusters available of the cluster in five dimensions. This isn't the kind of thing where you just work on your little PC and invent an idea. This is a situation where you invent an idea and then you get a 12,000 node cluster and try it out. Okay, and that's daunting. Definitely
daunting. Is gauge field spread out in five dimensions?
Yes, you have to make prescriptions on what to do with the gauge field in four plus five dimensions. And typically there's no gauge field in the five dimensions. Okay, but you have a full gauge field in the four dimensions.
Is it natural?
I don't think it's natural, but that's what works in the QCD view. Okay. Now, in other, you know, domain wall fermions are also used in strings and in theories beyond the standard model, in which case gauge fields are also put in fifth dimension. Yeah. But I think that there's some flexibility there. For us, it's an engineering problem. But the easiest thing to do and the most effective thing to do, so that the four dimensional theory is what we like. And I don't think the final word on that has been spoken. A related development in all of this is another thing that's interesting, in the sense that it shows you a great deal of flexibility and inventiveness that comes into lattice gauge theory formulation. And in the context of fermions, this is InSpar, the Wilson fermions, okay, which is very closely related to this, but a slightly different perspective. Okay, so. Long ago, okay, when people were doing exact renormalization group transformations and discussing fixed points of action, these fellows did that for theories with fermions, okay, and they were interested in fixed points of QCD, and by definition that theory should be chirally symmetric. That was what they wanted, and then they found that a relationship that came from that prescription, which was that gamma 5, when it's anti-commuted with the lattice Dirac operator, okay, typically you learn in field theory that for massless fermions that should be zero. That's not zero in this particular case. These guys found that for finite lattices lattice finite cutoff generalization of a continuum expression had a right-hand side which was hidden from zero, and it was given by exactly this. Early derivations of this formula were complicated and easy ways of doing it. Are in fact understandable now. So the idea then in Ginsburg-Wilson, don't think about five dimensions or anything like that, but just jigger up a lattice discrete difference, okay, which will satisfy this particular condition, and then you'll be in good shape. Now, okay. An interesting other way of looking at this is that typically the symmetry of chiral symmetry is just to do a rotation, a gamma 5 rotation on a fermion like this. That's typically the symmetry of a continuum theory. And that's what's of interest in QCD and controls pion dynamics and all of that. a development of this because of the importance of the Ginsburg-Wilson relation was to think of, well, maybe this isn't the right generalization, okay, of the chiral symmetry to go on the lattice. And in fact, the point was made that if this is going to be an exact symmetry of your theory, that underlying symmetry, which you are discussing, is in fact not that, but it feels the lattice spacing, and it looks like this, okay? Anyone can work out that this expression is actually the lattice generalization of that. Okay, and the point was then made that if you can implement this symmetry on a lattice, that then your fermion dynamics will naturally satisfy the Ginsburg-Wilson relationship, and you'll have the chiral symmetries that you're interested in. Detailed calculations show that the Flavin symmetry would be exact, that you'd get the right anomaly, and all of that, which I don't have time to discuss. Then the issue was, well, that's great. Write down a D that satisfies all that. That satisfies the Ginsburg-Wilson relation, because the naive difference is definitely gone. None of the differences I wrote down there can do that. The Wilson difference that's jiggered to get rid of species doubling doesn't satisfy that. So the issue was, what does the trick? Well, you can do the trick, and I think I'll violate my law and give credit to Herbert for this. Okay, fine. Because it's very, very important development, and showing that there was an existence, that there was a solution you could write down both the ice in this game. And the simplest example was the following thing, I'll motivate this, but I'm not going to allow him to. If you take the difference, the Wilson Dirac operator, I hinted at it, I didn't write it down, okay, and then look at this piece, okay, and then make this particular piece, this D satisfies the relationship exactly, and it looks rather awkward, but it's nicely motivated. So that's another game. I haven't had to discuss five dimensions at all. Later work showed that this is very closely related to domain fermions, that in fact they satisfy the Ginsburg-Wilson relationship. Okay, so everything's on a firm theoretical. One of the things you worry about looking at this sucker here, look, here's the difference operator upstairs, here's the difference operator downstairs to the square root. Okay, and so you have to. So you notice right away that teaching this fellow to a computer is a pain in the neck, right? For a nice, simple, discrete difference, teaching that to a computer is easy. Just calculate the guy here, take a difference, no sweat. Okay, teaching it this thing, okay, is quite hard, but it's not impossible. And it's not pathological. It looks like it might be pathological to have long-range couplings and things like that, but it isn't really so bad. And so people are spending a good deal of time, because of the good chiral structure here, to simulate this fellow on the lattice as well, and there'll be a large, important discussions of all of that in the workshop. What we want to be able to do is really to do QCD. QCD has two light flavors, a strange flavor that's heavier, and charm flavors in top and bottom, which you get higher than that. And so we need a fermion method that can handle some of that complexity. And although these methods are extremely computer intensive, they are on firmer ground than the earlier ones, and everyone will be looking at them strongly. Okay, so that's the idea of these fermions. Now, another topic that the conference will be looking at. Is aspects of QCD at high temperature or in extreme environments. So let me talk a little bit about high temperature. Okay, high temperature. From long ago, we know that the expectation is that if you take lattice gauge theory or pure Yang-Mills and heat it up, you should come to a phase transition to a plasma. If you were doing the case of just pure gauge field dynamics, you should go from you should have a transition from confinement to deconfinement. let me just motivate that to you, because again, I want to show you some of the tricks of the trade of lattice gauge theory that people are exploiting on the analytics side. Let me give you an example of that phase transition, just a simple situation. Let's take a lattice. Maybe it's just a two-dimensional lattice or three-dimensional lattice or whatever, and let's put on the links a variable, okay? Just take a statistical mechanical model. Let the links be phases, okay? Okay. So the links are going to be phases. They'll live at sites, okay? And then they'll be coupled up in some particular way. If I was making a lattice gauge theory, I'd couple up links around plot cuts in some particular way. I want to discuss this theory from a Hamiltonian perspective, and so I want the canonical momentum to this phase, and well, think of phi as just an angle, just a variable. This looks like a state of definite angular momentum, so my variable that will generate shifts in that would be just the good old angular momentum. I'll call it L, okay, of R and N. And sometimes I'll call it E, because it's really an electric field type variable. And then phi on this particular site, when commuted with L, should be 1. And if they're on different sites, it shouldn't commute at all. Okay, so that might be a kind of lattice, a kind of a physical situation for me. Just phases on links and a continuum of time, again, just to illustrate this. And then someone might want to do the thermodynamics of this, and so he'd want to calculate the partition function and just weigh each of the configurations, okay, by the Hamiltonian divided by KT, the physical temperature. That's what he would want to do. Okay, he'd have to know the Hamiltonian, and I'll write that down in just a minute. I just wrote down the degrees of freedom instead. Now, when he does that, he'll have to be careful about gauge invariants, and so when he sums over all possible states, he'll want to sum over states which are gauge invariant. And this finally, that just means that if I put the charge in, it gives rise to an electric field which carries one unit of flux. Okay. And so, but I have to. But that's important in the whole game, of course. I don't want to sum over unphysical states, so I put the prime over there. Okay, just to remind me. And gauge invariance is just then the statement. Okay, that in the vacuum, or whatever comes into a site leaves the site. Okay, and so the sum of the generators hitting the ground state is zero. Okay, just the statement of gauge invariance. Now we want to make the Hamiltonian here. Okay, and the Hamiltonian is what can I make it out of? I can make it out of L. Okay, and the simplest Hamiltonian, which actually is of interest, is just some of the squares of L's all around the lattice. To make contact with conventional normalizations, I'll put a G squared here, which is the coupling, and then I better put a proper number of 1 over lattice spacing so the dimensions work out. 1 over twice A works like that. So that's a Hamiltonian. It's interesting. That's a particularly interesting one because, in fact, when G is large, when G is large, this is right. Okay, this is right. Okay, in the sense that when the coupling is very large, the electric field pieces of the Hamiltonian dominate it. Okay, and so it's sensible to look at this as a model Hamiltonian for strong coupling. If I was doing all couplings, there would also be additional pieces here, and they behave like 1 upon G squared. Okay, so all one's trying to do is to illustrate the fact that if you take a strong coupling lattice gauge theory and heat it up, you'll find a phase transition. Okay, and if you're going to do continuum physics, you've got to work hard. Okay, but then the point was this. I'll drop a name again. Polyakov made the point here. He said that I know this Hamiltonian here. This system here is just sum over all the integers. Okay, with this constraint, and the Hamiltonian just goes like a square of an integer divided by kT. Okay, so you're summing over integers, and he said, well, that's an unusual looking problem. It's like a solid-on-solid problem. Okay, I'm going to deal with that, okay, by Fourier transforming. I'll be getting rid of the sum over integers and replace it by an integral over the speed variable. So he does a Fourier transform. Okay? And then if you do that, you'll get from that z to an equivalent one. And this is an exercise in Fourier transforming, nothing tougher than that. Okay? For each link now, when you do a Fourier transform, you'll get a continuous variable on each site. So I'll just indicate that by an alpha. And then you do your work and you find what the Boltzmann factor turns into, and it turns into a planar model. Okay. So just like this. Okay, so it turns into a planar model. And tricks of the trade, just stealing tricks of the trade from statistical mechanics. Okay, you can Fourier transforming, you can do that. So what's interesting about that? Well, one of the things interesting about that is that you illustrate a map. People are always looking for maps, okay, to solve their problems. This strong coupling problem was hard. Now you've mapped it from a problem perhaps at a temperature T is over here, to a problem over here, where beta is downstairs, to a problem of 1 over T, and you map the gauge theory, okay, you map the gauge theory at T into a spin system, okay, at temperature 1 upon T. So it's a kind of duality, okay, and of course, lattice gauge theory is full of those, and they're used to solve and get insight into these problems by slip exact methods. Okay, well, what's the physics of the phases? Okay, see now this is a planar model. You know this has two phases. Okay, this spin model. It has two phases. It has a disordered phase and an ordered phase. What does that mean from the perspective of gauge theory? So you answer that not by just looking at the partition function, but look at spin correlation function. Oh, in other words, well, let's start off in the gauge theory discussion. Okay, let's put a quark on one side, okay, and an anti-quark on another side. Okay, and calculate the partition function for that. So over here, I'll put a quark, which means that the sum of the e's coming into that site, okay, doesn't give me 0, it gives me 1. And then over here, okay, I'll put an anti-quark, so I'll sum over the sites, the links going into there, okay, and then instead of giving me 1, they're giving minus 1, okay? So the rules are the same, except change just accommodate static sources of color and make the state a color singlet in that way. Okay, well then, it's an easy exercise. I just have to look more closely at this sum, put in the Kronecker symbols to enforce this on the two special sites, and then what I'll see is that the partition function, and then I'll do my Fourier transforming, and I'll see that the partition function for the correlation function now depends upon the distance between the source and the sink, and it maps onto what could be nice of the spin-spin correlation function. Okay, for the spin system. Okay, so that's an exact result of just Fourier transforming. Okay, but now you see you're all set to get a physical interpretation of the gauge theory as a function of temperature, because you understand the spin system as a function of temperature. In particular, the spin system when its temperature is low. Okay, spin system, okay, at low T, okay, well let's say the spin system, I'm getting confused, the spin system, let's let its temperature be high, so at low T. Okay, so the physical temperature of the gauge field is low, which means that the physical temperature of the spin system is high because of the flipping of that. Well, then what does the correlation function look like? The spin system is hot, so the correlation function written down like that, of course, falls off with a dynamically generated correlation length called mu, and it falls off exponentially. You know that really from general principles,
and that's the property of the spin system. The correlations are short-ranged, and so the correlation function falls off exponentially. What's interesting about that, then, is then to look back at what does that say for the gauge theory? Well, here's the partition function for the gauge theory. I can do all of this. And what I really would rather discuss rather than partition function go to free energies. How much energy does it cost for this particular configuration? Well, the free energy is just the logarithm of the partition function. So I'll take the logarithm of the partition function that we calculate. I'll subtract off the energy of the ground state without the impurities in there, and then there's just a factor of beta like this. Okay, so free energy now for the gauge theory looks like that. So I can take the logarithm of this particular fellow, okay, without the sources, and I see that the exponential damping of the correlation function means, in fact, that the extra free energy of the quark and the antiquark at low temperature in its phase is just confinement. Okay? In other words, this R becomes this R over here. Right? So what you're just finding then is that the gauge theory does have two phases, and the lowest energy phase is the phase where the energy between the quark and the antiquark grows as the distance between them, and you interpret that as the presence of an electric flux tube between them. Okay. Now, if you go to the other extreme and look at the spin system at low temperature for it, or at high temperature for the gauge field. Okay. Then the correlation function becomes a constant it just becomes magnetized. Okay. And then the correlation function approaches a constant. In this particular case, it approaches a constant exponentially, although that's not really key. But it approaches it exponentially, like 1 upon e to the 1 upon r is the way it works in an Heisenberg model. And then you see that the free energy in the quark case is then short-ranged. The 1 upon r here, take the logarithm, get 1 upon r. And you'll get the g squared over r. Right? So you're just finding. So you can find the transition and understand it by doing this duality now, and it gives you some insight into the mechanism of confinement through linearly rising potentials, flux tube formations, and then at high temperature, the thermal fluctuations are breaking up the flux tube, making a vacuum that's a bubbling broth of loops, leading to a kind of screening, giving you a residual energy between the quark and the antiquark that falls off like 1 upon r. It's interesting to take this calculation, put matter into it, and there are lots of games that you can play. But one of the reasons people study lattice gauge theory then at high temperatures is to understand the mechanism of confinement and try to deal with these issues in the continuum limit. 110. Okay. What? So I won't talk about temperature anymore. Let's jump to chemical potential because I might as well embarrass myself. The problem I worked on for a long time and it's beaten me to a pulp. Okay, but it's interesting, and it's one of those problems where lattice gauge theory really hasn't gotten very far, and it might someday. So people will be looking at that. Let's look at chemical potential. That doesn't sound so tough. So you're interested in nuclear physics from the fundamentals, right? You want to discuss systems with non-nuclear matter, but you want to understand it now from a QCD perspective, and that turns out not to be too easy. So chemical potential. So in STATMEC, you do chemical potential, the partition function, sum over states, and then each state is weighed by a Boltzmann factor. And then if you couple in chemical potential, you'll couple a chemical potential to the conserved number. In our case, that conserved number of interest is baryon number, and it looks like that. Okay. The situation at finite temperature is wonderful. Lattice gauge theory has provided tremendous insight into QCD at finite temperature. It's done quantitative calculations. It can tell you the transition temperature, and it can tell you the universality classes of the transitions, all sorts of stuff. In chemical potential, we're not going to get anywhere. Okay, so it's that's where you should be working. Well, no, don't. too many classes. Okay, but anyway, if you had, let's say it's fermions first, right? In free fermions, we all know what happens. You crank up the chemical potential. You fill up the system to a Fermi level. Okay, so N, the occupation number, is a function of momentum versus momentum. Okay, for mu different from zero, you'll just fill up states. Okay, out to a Fermi momentum, and for free fermions, the Fermi momentum will just be related to the chemical potential, the energy of the Fermi level by such an expression. So that's fine and dandy. Now, in the early days of QCD, people looked at this, and then can they imagine a situation where the density was very, very high, mu was very, very big, okay? And then they argued, well, QCD is a complicated theory, lots of interactions, but if mu is very, very big, you put into the theory a very high energy scale, and maybe asymptotic freedom works. Okay, and so therefore maybe the system looks like a free bunch of quarks and gluons, and therefore as a function of chemical potential, you should have a phase transition between a low chemical potential theory, which is hadronic-like, with strings confining quarks and anti-quarks, to a situation where mu is very, very large, where it's a weakly interacting system. The order parameter for that situation might be dynamical symmetry breaking again. Okay, where at low mu you have it, at high mu the system looks basically free, and you don't have it. So the order parameter might be psi bar psi. At the same time, people were saying those words. People noticed also that that's not quite right, because there is superconductivity out there. Okay, if you have any attractive interaction whatsoever at the surface of the at the Fermi surface, then you know the VCS mechanism will come into play. And you'll generate VCS condensate, okay, and you'll have a state of superconductivity, and that's almost generic as long as you have some attraction between quarks at the top of the Fermi surface. Okay, well, quarks in SU3 carry a color charge 3. And 3 cross 3, the diquark quantum numbers will be a 3 bar plus a 6. And if you look at the interactions, you'll see that the diquarks that form a 3 bar experience attraction. Okay, if mu is very large, I don't worry about confinement. Okay, that's the orthodoxy. And so I predict a color superconductor when mu is very, very large. And this was done in the earliest days of QCD. What has happened since then, and there's been an explosion of activity since then, was to look at the gap equation in more detail and understand it and try to make quantitative statements. In the earliest days of QCD, the diquark was found, and the gap associated with it was found to be extraordinarily small. More recent calculations indicate that gap might be 10 or 20 or 30 MeV, and so this state is not is much more robust than people had thought. Instantaneous calculations sort of suggest the same thing. A discussion of the dynamics that of the single gluon exchange between the quarks indicates that in fact it's magnetic, unscreened magnetic gluons that do the attraction, okay, that they satisfy an interesting scaling law, and that they lead to an instability and lead to a lot of this phenomenology. People discuss the symmetries of the three-bar quark condensate in the case of three massless quarks, up, down, and strange in the situation where you can treat them all as massless, like mu is very large, and then you get a state of color flavor locking, okay, is the symmetry of the order parameter, and there's a lot of phenomenology associated with that. The phenomenology, of course, may or may not be relevant to the real world, because if you look at those equations and ask how high does mu have to be in order to believe a single gluon exchange, you get an estimate of about 10 to the 6 MeV. Okay? Nuclear mass, you know, the densest nuclear stars have a chemical potential of 100 or 2. Okay, and you're 6 orders of magnitude removed from that. But high energy physicists don't let a factor of 10 to the 6 in the way. They say they do phenomenology for neutron stars as, you know, buying color superconductivity, and I think that's fine, but, you know. It's a little bit, okay. But it's not in the spirit of lattice cage theory. Okay, well, we're trying to. Okay. Well, sometimes we think about the, a 10% calculation rather than an error of a million parts in one. Okay. Okay. Now, let's talk about lattice gauge theory. Why is lattice gauge theory completely unable to deal with this? The trouble with lattice gauge theory is that when mu is different from zero, the action of lattice gauge theory becomes complex. Okay, for SU3, and we don't have any of our simulation tricks. Our simulation tricks are based on having a probability interpretation of the theory, and we're basically lost. Okay, in particular, maybe there's no need to write that down because I don't have very much time. When mu is non-zero, action for lattice gauge theory, and they integrate out the fermions. They come up with a fermion determinant, as you do in all those stat-mech problems that you do, where you integrate out the fermions because they're Graskin variables, they're nasty little beasts. You integrate them out and get a fermion determinant. And when mu is different from zero in SU3, it's complex, and you have very few games that you can play. Okay. So then, in fact, simulations haven't helped in this particular game. Well, there's a funny thing here, though, because, you know, the most progress made in gauge theory was in an old approximation where you set the fermion determinant to 1. You forgot the fermion. And when you did the dynamics of QCD in the early days, you said, well, most of the dynamics is in blue. Okay, and the fermion provides screening, but that's not the bulk of the dynamics, so let's throw the fermion determinant out. Let's take the number of fermions and set it to zero, and although that's embarrassing, give that approximation a name, so it's not so embarrassing, call it the quenched approximation. and you don't have to think about that. So you take NF to zero, the fermion determinant goes away, there are no fermions left in the game, and then your problem is much like electrons propagating in a disordered medium. You look at the influence of the medium on the fermions, but you don't look at the impact of the fermions back on the disordered medium. Very sensible leading order approximation, and was very important in QCD spectroscopy in the early days. If you do that for non-zero chemical potential, you find a complete disaster. Okay, if you do that, what do you expect for QCD as a function of chemical potential? Well, if you're coupling to the baryon chemical potential, you would expect that once the chemical potential hit the mass of the lightest baryon, that you would then get a phase transition. It would be a phase transition that would lead to chiral symmetry breaking. Chiral symmetry restoration. So your expectation, okay, was that when you crank up mu in QCD, you would find a phase transition to a plasma. You condense those baryons, you make a new state in which the baryons overlap, and a plasma-like state. And the mu critical would be just the mass of the nucleon. In the language of quarks carry a third baryon, so you expected this. Okay, so 1,000 MeV over 300 MeV was what you expected. You do the simulations in the case of the quenched approximation for non-zero quark mass, and what you found instead was not this. You found mass of the pion over 2. okay? And that was found in the early simulations of the theory. In fact, what you found was that as you made the quartz lighter and lighter, the critical chemical potential went to zero, and a totally exasperating result. Okay, well, it was pointed out that in the context of random matrix methods, again, analytic methods, that in fact that was expected, in the sense that you have to, when you take this limit of nf to zero, okay, is the point of no quarks analytically connected to ordinary QCD, the theory that you're interested in, or is it connected to something else? The funny thing is, of course, that when nf is equal to zero, the action is real, okay, and fine. When nf is different from zero in QCD, the action is complex, and there's no real connection between them. It was pointed out that when nf goes to zero, the limit you're taking is in fact QCD, okay, plus nf fermions, okay, plus nf conjugate fermions. In other words, and this is a theory, you see, which is analytically connected to Planck's QCD, because if you have fermions in the game and conjugate fermions, even when nf is different here, this theory has a real determinant. Okay, so in fact, just setting nf to zero doesn't get you the nf equals zero limit of QCD. It gets you the nf zero limit of this fellow, and this fellow has too much symmetry. It has fermions and conjugate fermions. So for every meson state, which is a QQ bar, you have an identical in energy state, which is QQ. Okay, because of the conjugate fermion. So this theory, it has a spectrum which isn't simply connected to QCD, because if there's a pion in this theory, there's also a baryon in this theory. It's colorless because of the conjugate fermion. So I really should write it something like this, okay? Which carries baryon number, but whose mass goes to zero, it tracks the pion mass, and that's a disaster. So the Planck's approximation, because it dealt with real actions, failed completely. The lattice gauge theory is doing something. We can't handle cases. Lattice gauge theory has nothing to say at the moment about mu bars, mu different from zero, and t zero. It just can't handle that. But that's an interesting situation in experimental physics, which lattice gauge theory might have some relevance to, and that's the relativistic heavy ion colliders. Okay, there you're interested in the theories of function of temperature and the function of chemical potential. Okay, and so his QCD is a function of T and U. As you crank up the temperature for a zero chemical potential, you'll find a phase transition. Let's imagine three massless fermions. Okay, you'll find a phase transition between a hadronic-like state and a quark gluon plasma-like state up here, and it's a healthy phase transition. We can't do QCD out here, but we can do models of QCD out here. And if you do models of QCD, you'll tend to find phase diagrams like this. Phase diagram like this, where this is a, for a while, okay, this is the second order. So we'll find a phase diagram like that. In various special cases, it might be that there's a tricritical point in the game. So that down here, the transition is first order. This is, okay, stuff really phenomenal in second order up here. That's a possibility, a second order up here for massless fermions. Two, maybe three fermions like that, with a tricritical point. So if you make a model of nuclear physics, like a short-range model of attraction between fermions, phase diagrams of this kind will emerge. And if those models have fermion decoupers that do not become complex, they can also be simulated, and people verify in simulation a phase diagram like this. You're particularly interested in this tricritical point here. Now, real QCD isn't that way. Real QCD, the fermions aren't quite massless, so the second order line becomes a crossover. Okay, like this. And then what we're interested in, perhaps the most interesting thing, is then to find the endpoint of the line of first-order transitions, this endpoint. That's what people will be discussing at the conference. What is the temperature of the endpoint of the line in the transition region? Okay, now, but I said that you don't have a simulation method for lattice gauge theory for non-zero chemical potential, and that's true in general. But let's say you're just interested in this region of the phase diagram. Then even without a general algorithm, you might be able to solve the problem, and people have tried to do that. What they tend to do is to generate an ensemble here, which is very large indeed. And then they try to work out a non-zero chemical potential by reweighting that ensemble. So it's a kind of, if you do simulations in statistical mechanics, you know, Fehrenberg-Swenson methods. So they have a two-parameter kind of a Sverenberg-Svensson method, which will then generate over here, will rewrite the ensembles over here, and make a new ensemble over here, which experiences the rapid crossover from hydronic matter, okay, to quark gluon to plasma model matter, okay, and is sufficiently accurate that you believe the details here. Now. Some of this is tough, and there's a lot of hocus pocus in this game, because look, if I just move out here from an ensemble here to an ensemble at the same temperature and non-zero mu, the overlap of that holds on two ensembles will typically be exponentially small in the volume of the system. But if you take a lattice action and just tweak the local parameters a little bit. Okay, then the Boltzmann factor changes exponentially quickly in the size of the system. Okay, so you're dead. Okay, so what's important in this game is that if you change the temperature, if you change mu positively, however, if you also decrease the temperature at the same time, the overlap between this configuration and this ensemble here can be maintained rather healthy. Okay, and you can track this line of rapid crossovers, and maybe you can get out to the end point. That's the kind of games people are playing. It's pretty dirty business, right? I mean, I'm not even going to try to write down the formulas for the thing, but it's a manipulation of a Fehrenberg-Swenson type of thing, and you have to monitor the plaquette or some susceptibilities to try to stay near that line as you move in this direction. Then you'll get a new ensemble here, maybe at that point you're calculating a thin cumulant and see if you're near an endpoint. Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe you'll calculate the zeros of the partition function on that finite size system and see if Yang Li zeros are starting to crowd the axes indicative of the presence of a real phase transition rather than a crossover here. And those are the games that people are playing, and that will be. And we'll be discussing all those games at the conference. People take different sides on this one. Okay, people say you can't beat that exponential, and other people say, well, for the present size lattice, that exponential is just e to the minus to the 10 to the 8, and maybe I can deal with it. Maybe I can make that coefficient of the 10 to the 8 small enough that I can get a certain distance out here to get. This temperature is on the order of 155 MeV, and all you want to do is get mu out here 10 or 20, so maybe you can do it. Well, so it's pretty much an art at this time. If people could really find a method of simulation for us to find a chemical potential, then we'd really be cooking, but we're not really there yet. I've gone over my time, and I apologize for that. Come to some of the lattice workshop meetings, those that might pique your interest, and maybe you'll have something to say about them, because the language of lattice is a lot like the language of stationary and solid state physics, and you probably have something to teach. Okay. Questions?
I remember there was a paper who tried to simulate finite chemical potential using Swanson algorithm and the Kuster algorithm. Is there any success, or
I don't, people are trying to, again, use cluster algorithms and try to isolate pieces of problems that are purely real.
Right.
Okay, and then find
the pieces. Sign problem is.
Sign problem is isolated. I think they haven't made progress on that particular. I think it tends to get away from you. As soon as the chemical potential gets into the interesting region, the sign problems come up with a vengeance. You can calculate the determinant. Okay, on these things, and it really gets out of hand. Okay, so that any assumption about regularity in the sign problem falls by the wayside. Now, some people pursue a different method, which really only works for high temperature and small chemical potential, which is to simulate the theory of imaginary chemical potential. Okay, if the potential is imaginary, then the determinant is real. Okay, and that'll work as long as mu over the temperature is small enough. And that does give competing answers for this, and also has shown some indication of the existence of this critical point. Okay, so there's some
questions. So you say that there's only a crossover, not a phase transition between a hadron and this plasma. Right. So does that mean that in principle quarks are not quite truly bound at sufficient
Eisenstein
scales, or?
Actually, it's screening. As soon as you put a quark mass into the game, okay, that's, in the realistic situations, they don't do massless quarks. Okay, that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
If the mass is different from zero, then chiral symmetry is non-exact symmetry, and you replace the line of transitions by a rapid crossover region. Okay, so in that particular case, you have dynamical quarks in a game, and in the hydronic phase, if you pull a quark and an anti-quark apart, the dynamical quark can pop out of the vacuum and scream. Okay? Then if you have very high chemical potential at a very high temperature, the same phenomena occurs. And so confinement is not a good symmetry, is not a good order around up to those theories. So you look at chiral symmetry, and that's the best you can do.
No. So what do you say about Bohm therapy?
it's an interesting thing that in string theory for example the basic electrodynamics is not Maxwell's, it's an electrodynamics of Born-Infeld, because in string theory there's an upper bound to a tension or to an energy density. Maxwell's theory of course has no bound on it. Born-Infeld was a theory from the early days of QED, which put a bound on the energy density of electromagnetic phenomena. So that the action of that Born-Infeld wrote down many, many years ago is now the action of QED that comes out as bosonic strings. Okay. Now that action is highly nonlinear. So lattice gauge theory to the rescue. You simulate Born-Infeld theories and try to study Born-Infeld. There was at least in four dimensions, but I had really in 10 or 26 dimensions. Although I guess, I was always finding away from domain wall Fermi. So maybe that's a stupid thing to say. But anyway, so there's an interest in understanding Born-Infeld as its problem in simulations, and understanding the screening in Born-Infeld outside of the range of classical physics to see what kind of theory it is. So, people are getting into that and trying to learn from string theory.
But that theory is non-normalizable, so it's not going to exist by itself as opposed to as a low energy of the string theory. I think it has non-linear symmetries that might allow it to exist. I mean, you have some indication.
That's what we're going to study.
We don't know about that.
Even
if you're Abelian theory, you probably
we're going to the Abelian theory first, and we'll just look at that, and then we'll just try to understand that as a function of the parameters, and then we'll look for a critical point and look for maybe an existence of the theory. That's the kind of problems we're working on. It's exploratory work in program recommendation and the allocation board said yes, but it we don't know about it. But it's an interesting, it brings up all these issues that are very interesting to the basis of theory. I'm very interested in theories. These are theories that have an upper limit to the acceleration, and that's very interesting.
Okay, John, thanks for this overview.